Hello, and welcome to More Than a Movie, the weekly show about films and filmmaking here on Campus FM. My name's Andrew Bonello, and along with a guest I'll welcome very shortly, we'll take a journey into the magical world of movies. Let's explore why films can be such a powerful reflection of real life's struggles and joys, making them so much more than just a movie. This week, we're exploring chilling films that go deep on psychology. Whether we're in crime drama, thriller, or even supernatural horror territory, let's delve into stories that are less about action, gore, and on-the-nose storytelling. Rather, movies that explore the psychology of those deepest, darkest recesses of the human mind. Coming up later, what's a mother to do when her terrified kid won't sleep because there's a monster under his bed?
You alright?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You don't have to be fine, you know.
Just a bit stressed at the moment.
All children see monsters.
Not like this.
When a surly snowboarding trip goes off-piste, these teens wonder, are they being threatened by something outside their stranded vehicle?
Go around this bend.
That's the same path we went down an hour ago.
Derek, look out!
Someone has to go for help.
And a traumatized ex-soldier returns to life at home with his girlfriend and a new kind of nightmare.
Maybe it's the pressure, Jake.
They're like demons, Jess. They weren't human.
What were they, Jake?
But before we get to that, let me begin by introducing our guest this week. Theatre director and actor Stephen Oliver has been on stage since the ripe old age of 12. He trained at the Webber Douglas Academy of Dramatic Art in London and has worked in the UK, the USA and Europe. Stephen has resided and worked in Malta since 2013. And to discuss his experiences and views, he joins me in the studio today. Stephen, welcome to the show.
And good day to you too. It's very nice to be here, Andrew.
Great to have you here, Stephen. So, let's start. Tell me, how was your love for film and theatre born?
Well, I actually remember the very first film my parents ever took me to, which was the... This shows you how old I am. which was the original version of 101 Dalmatians.
Wow.
In a huge cinema in my hometown of Gloucester in the Cotswolds.
Okay.
And I remember being terrified by Cruella de Vil and having nightmares for many weeks after that. But that was my very first ever movie that I saw. But I've always been interested in... I'm not a massive fan of kind of rom-coms and those kinds of things. I've always been really interested in the kind of psychological... I mean, weirdly, both my daughters and myself are obscene... obsessed with crime, forensics, serial killers. I mean, we share the same Netflix site, and we can look at each other's profile.
Right, right.
And sometimes I look at my daughter's profile and go, Alex, do we need to talk? Because...
Blimey, what are you watching?
What are you watching? But I've always been fascinated by the... I love, as a director, manipulating an audience and manipulating their emotions.
Yes.
So I suppose that kind of comes from that kind of... my love for kind of thrillers and things that mess with your head and you're not sure and things that don't come to a conclusion very easily. I get very disappointed if I watch a thriller and I kind of know what's going to happen.
Right. If you can
read
it
halfway through, you know, I love it when you get sort of 10 minutes before the end and you go, aha, now I get it. So I'm kind of into those kinds of things. Do you understand me?
No? Yeah. I mean, this is a really interesting point you make, because I mean, I think about this a lot, and I suppose you could argue that film or sort of storytelling, especially visual as a whole, is a kind of manipulation of the audience.
Oh, totally.
We're always sort of, as film creators, giving them cues about how to think and feel. But is that fair? Like, if we talk about, like, just general sort of more dramas and comedies, is that manipulation still going on? It's obviously really happening with psychological thrillers.
Yeah, I use it a lot I'm quite well known for this. In quite a lot of the plays that I direct, I often use underscore during scenes, which is a very filmic thing, of course. And sometimes it's because... if the audience were bordering on crying, that just that piece of music drifting in underneath, it's probably going to turn the screws.
Yes.
Do you understand me?
Yes.
Or
yes.
I like these kind of sudden noises. When I did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, every scene was punctuated by the sound of a door being slammed. to kind of give you this feeling that these guys are never going to escape from this place.
Right, right.
It, you know, it's that kind of sting, that musical sting that kind of punctuates it. So, yeah, it does go on in theatre a lot, I think. It's a very good way of manipulating an audience. And taking them sometimes to places they don't necessarily want to go.
I mean, I was going to ask you about that because you've got like an extensive line of work both in theatre and film. But obviously, with theatre, the setting is different. We don't have quite the same sort of immersive possibilities of film with its up close framing and photography. So, with theatre, how do you approach getting the viewers over that sort of suspension of disbelief that they're watching a group of people on a stage?
I think it's just a question of transporting them to a new world. For example, when I did Amadeus a few years ago, I had wraparound sound inside the Manuel Theatre.
Right.
So when some of this huge Mozart music was playing at some very specific dramatic moments, like when Mozart dies, when Salieri breaks down, the music rises to this huge crescendo and the audience are somewhere else. You know, they forget they're in the theater. I had a girl in the cast who sang opera live with a full orchestration behind it.
Mm.
Suddenly you're transported. I used a lot of big projections, but they were perspective projections. So when you looked at the inside of the Schoenberg Palace, it looked like you were looking straight down the hallway of the gallery.
Like it was perspective.
Absolutely. Correct. It was very cleverly put together by the set designer and myself in terms of trying to take the audience, make them forget that they're actually sitting in a theatre. I've also used live cameras on stage in productions before.
So and then, an alternate.
Yeah, so the audience sometimes in specific dramatic moments, like maybe a character's very sad monologue, that live camera comes in closer and closer, and then that image is projected either onto screens or television screens or whatever. The audience kind of... I like giving an audience more than one thing to look at a time. And that's quite filmic as well, if you think about it.
I was going to say, yeah.
You know, your eye is on what's going on in the main action, but your eye tends to drift away to other things that might be happening in the background. So I'm quite into that kind of way of deceiving an audience, if you like.
Right, that's interesting because it's a different medium in that respect. It's kind of a parallel medium, right? Because with film, you cut, you show different shots, and you're very prescriptive about what the audience is going to
exactly.
see. Exactly. But with a theatre, you've got a panoply of possible places they can look.
Exactly.
Hmm. So, but you're saying you also sometimes offer them close-ups, a la film.
Absolutely. Right. In fact, the last show I directed, I used film behind the whole piece.
This was...
WTC, which was the 9/11 piece that I did at the Mammoth Theatre last year, which had like 10 physical theatre performers. A huge driving soundtrack. I mean, we added so many speakers into the Mammoth Theatre, including ones under the stage as well for real resonance.
Gosh.
And then this amazing film footage going on. I managed to source some quite rare 9/11 footage.
Yes, I noticed because I had the luck to watch it shown on TVM last month, and some of it's quite striking footage.
Exactly. And going back to this kind of manipulation thing, we looked at, for example, the people that sadly fell from the buildings.
Mm.
How could we do that justice in terms of physically and while you're watching what's going on physically on stage and you're seeing the imagery on the screen and the music kind of lent itself to all that scene as well. A lot of people said they were hugely touched by the whole thing. They cried, they kind of emotion. So it is, that's using media to kind of still enhance the work, if you like.
Absolutely, and we had Michaela Ferrugia on the show a few weeks back.
Marvelous performer.
One of your performers.
Yeah. I've worked with her many times.
Yes, I was hoping to dig in a little bit about the choreography of that piece, because, as you say, there's essentially an ongoing music soundtrack and video accompaniment, but your performers were pretty much always...
They were on stage throughout.
Things.
Oh, throughout.
How was that developed? I mean, how did you come up with the actions to complement, for example, these terrible images of the World Trade Center?
This started many years ago, about 5 years ago, and I developed this. I started developing this piece as a 20-minute showcase thing for mature students at Stagecoach.
Okay.
But I always had an intention to develop it into a much larger piece. And then a call came out from the Manuel, who, bless their hearts, trying to get some kind of season started. And I had already worked over the years developing it. And they said, you know, it had to be no more than 10 performers and it had to be no more than an hour long. And when I looked at the soundtrack and the film, it was 56 minutes. So it was bang on the money. So then I approached the Manuel and they said yes. And then what I basically did was, the 9/11 story was a kind of first piece of history that unraveled in front of us.
In real time.
In real time. And for me, it kind of broke down into episodes. Mm-hmm. And so I broke it down into 8 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ordinary people on the street, the people in their offices.
Commuting.
You know, exactly. All of those kind of things. Then we tried to mechanically work out the kind of things that we do in an ordinary day, like working in an office, and then extend that into physical movement. And that's how that came about. Obviously, the Fall Free number, which is the one about the people dropping from the buildings, we played a lot around with falls and rolls and those kinds of things. So every piece you watched was different. It had a different physical style to it.
Right.
And that was a very deliberate decision on my part. Mm-hmm. So working with the choreographer and my kind of ideas and the performers themselves, the whole piece was devised out of that. I mean, it's a huge marathon for performers.
I was going to say, there's so much in the way of learning.
Huge amounts. Mm. Huge amounts. And that's kind of how that... So I've always been interested in doing multimedia type stuff as well.
Right.
So I kind of wanted to try and combine the film, music, and... Absolutely. I mean, the soundtrack came first, actually.
Okay. That was your sort of base.
That was my base, and somebody had introduced me to this incredible band called Hybrid, who are a Welsh band. And all the music in that piece is all Hybrid, apart from 2 tracks, but their style is so different in each track that you don't really realise it.
Interesting.
So that's kind of how that piece developed.
And talk about the venue a little bit, because evidently you've put on a few productions at the Manuel Theatre.
Yes.
How is it working there as a space, as a performance venue?
Oh, it's an incredible venue to perform.
Been refitted fairly recently, hasn't it?
Exactly. I mean, I've also worked on that stage in Panto. I did the Crucible there and Noises Off and various other things. It's a great space to work in. And fair play to the Manuel Theatre last year, during all this horrific COVID thing, they tried to kick off a season of some description. It was COVID restricted. Fortunately, my piece was filmed.
Yes.
So, and then PBS picked up on it and it was kind of shown eventually, which is great because it reaches a bigger audience. And my intention with that piece is to try and punt it around international festivals and see if I can, because it comes as a package, indeed, if you like. So it's very easy to transport from one country to another.
Right.
So that's my kind of long-term goal. But it's a great space. I mean, all of the spaces I've been lucky enough to direct in, what used to be St. James Cavalier, Blue Box. So I've been very fortunate. The performance spaces here are very good, but very unique.
So it's interesting. So shifting to one of your other performance pieces, we talked about film and sort of essentially being used to manipulate the audience. You did a production of Festen at M Space.
Yes, in fact.
Which, of course, is based off of the Dogme movement, which tries, for viewers or listeners who might not be familiar, tries to invert all of that. They try to do away with lighting, to do away with sound effects, only recording of sound on set and so on.
Exactly.
Talk about that one.
Yes, because it's based on The Celebration, of course.
Right.
Yeah. I was very lucky because when I came to Malta, Tony Vizina, who runs Masquerade, asked me to direct what was in essence the premiere production in Blue Box. It was the very, very first production in Blue Box. It's a fascinating play and loses nothing from the movie in terms of, as very, you know, I tried to make it as realistic and naturalistic as possible without it feeling, if you like, theatrical.
Absolutely.
And I had a stunning cast, which included the great Manuel Cauchi, who I had the fortune to direct again as Salieri in Amadeus. So, okay. I couldn't have asked for a group of people to work with. And I was very influenced by the film. I mean, in fact, I saw the film first way before I ever directed the play and didn't make the connection, actually. Until I read Festen and I went, hang on a minute, I've seen this.
Right, this is
And I love that style of filmmaking. I think it's incredible. It kind of strips it down to basics. It gives it a very raw, you almost kind of feel like the actors are not saying lines. They're just kind of saying what they feel. And I'm a great believer in that. I hate going to watch actors act, right, if you like.
You want to always go for naturalism.
Absolutely, absolutely.
This is great. Okay, well, Stephen, let's change pace just a little bit. Today's show is about movies that go deep on psychology. And I think you had one that's a particular favourite of yours you wanted to share with us today.
Yes, I think probably my favourite film of all time is 12 Angry Men.
How can we be positive about anything? I don't understand you people. I mean, all these picky little points you keep bringing up, they don't mean nothing.
You are going to try a man for murder. The awesome power to kill will suddenly be thrust into your hand.
Watch them and pray, for someday you may become one of them. 12 men with the smell of violent death in their nostrils.
What's the matter with you guys? You're letting them slip through our fingers.
So from 1957, then, this is Sidney Lumet's classic crime drama, 12 Angry Men, starring Henry Fonda, of course. Well, it may not be a chiller in strict sense, but it's certainly a psychological movie. Stephen, what's so special about this one for you?
I think what's so clever about it, I mean, the actors they have assembled for that film are incredible, people like Lee J. Cobb and stuff. The filmmaking is tremendous. You've got these big close-ups that come in. It's all set in one venue. It's a jury room during a hot, stormy, summer, humid day where the water coolers, there's only a water cooler, the fan's not working properly, they can barely open the windows, and that adds to all the tension. I think what makes this film work for me is the way in which Henry Fonda's character, who doesn't necessarily believe that the person who's been accused is guilty, just thinks there's not enough evidence to make a case for him going to the electric chair.
Because it's a capital case.
Exactly. And it's the way in which slowly he systematically proves to the others that this is not the case, until finally the one person who was stand against him, Lee J. Cobb, finally cracks.
Right.
And I think that's, and then the film ends in this beautiful way where they go off to do their own worlds. Mm-hmm. And he says hello to the old man on the steps and asks him who he is and what his name is. And the film kind of ends that way. It's just, I think it's because it's set in one space. Mm-hmm. And it concentrates purely on character, nothing else. Each one of those 12 jury members has distinct personality traits, which you can identify really easily with.
That's a lot of characters,
yes,
though, isn't it?
12 people on stage, on film, all in one venue. And it's the way in which Reginald Rose, who wrote this, has weaved this beautiful reasoning for unwinding, if you like, a court case that really appealed to me. I was very lucky. Many years ago in England, I managed to direct the play of this in quite a smallish venue, because I deliberately wanted the audience to feel this kind of sense of claustrophobia. Mm-hmm. And it works as well on stage as it does on film. It's just beautifully written.
And how closely did you sort of model your theatrical production on the film's performances?
I always try and avoid this kind of thing. I mean, I've done many characters in plays that I've never seen the film versions of. In a way, it's always very dangerous, because there's a danger that you copy someone else's performance. For example, many years ago, I did Little Voice, Rise and Fall of Little Voice. I've never seen that film.
Okay.
I've never seen Michael Caine's performance in that film, in the character that I was playing. And in a way, I don't want to.
Right.
12 Angry Men, I loved the film anyway, but I deliberately avoided watching the film while I was directing the play.
Absolutely reasonable, you know, reason.
In a way, I kind of remembered things. It's like, oh, yeah. I mean, you can't change the atmospherics of a play. The atmosphere is still the same, if you like. It's still this humid environment, hostile environment.
But you want your performers, I suppose, to bring their own life
exactly.
to the roles.
I don't want them to go away and watch. I mean, the guy who was playing the Henry Fonda role,
right.
I didn't want him to watch the film, because it's very easy to pick up on that. And I don't really want that. I want a fresh approach.
Absolutely.
I've never seen, I mean, Tony Bazzina did a production of Amadeus here many years ago. I've never seen it.
Okay.
I came with fresh eyes, you know. I know his production was hugely successful, but I came with a complete fresh pair of eyes. I didn't want to see what had been done before. I didn't want to compare what had been done before. And in a way, that's kind of how I approach my theatrical work as well.
That's interesting, because there's another element to that, I think, which is productions that happen at different points in time also have a chance to sort of integrate the zeitgeist of the time.
Exactly.
And give them a sort of a contemporary spin, even if it's an old story.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, again, similarly, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the play is very different to the film. The play is closer to the book.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's all seen through the Native American Indian's eyes, the play. So it's a very different slant on that. Similarly, I directed A Clockwork Orange in Britain many years ago. The play is very different to the film.
I mean, I'll be honest about it. I was a huge fan of The Clockwork Orange, the book.
Yes.
The book was hilarious. If you're a native English speaker, the language in the book is brilliantly
funny. The play is much closer to the book.
Interesting. Yeah, the film, I know it's a great regarded film. It wasn't a particular favourite of mine.
So it wasn't a favourite of the writer either.
Interesting.
Yeah,
Burgess,
Burgess kind of turned his back on it.
Right.
Because he felt it had been, just the violence and the pornography of the film had been brought to the surface much more, and the gut story of the piece was missing. So he kind of disenfranchised himself originally from the film.
Interesting. Interesting conversation, Steve, because looking at your theatrical and your filmography, a lot of the titles you've tackled could be classified as sort of genre pieces.
Yes.
You've dealt with, you've mentioned the films that Milos Forman adapted onto film. Is this to say you feel that genre is a better way to sort of channel good drama? Because, you could have done, like, classic dramas, classic comedies, you've done some Shakespeare,
yeah.
But you tend to have an interest in genre pieces in particular. What's that coming from?
Sometimes it's not by choice. Okay. I mean, sometimes producers approach you and say, I'd like you to direct this for us, or... Mm-hmm. I also recently, over the last few years, have done quite a lot of new work that's new writing, which is, I find, very exciting. I directed a couple of plays for Adrian Buckle, which were brand new pieces. Okay. And he was very flexible because, he said, you're the director. If you don't think it works, you make it work in the way that you do. And they were very much not a genre of any description. I think it's just the way it's gone. I suppose I love storytelling, ultimately. And going back to what I was saying about the kind of manipulative stuff, I enjoy playing on an audience's emotions. I enjoy it. I enjoy it myself as a viewer.
Absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely, same here. Yeah.
I like being scared. I like being thrilled. I like being confused. I like all of those things. I like doing sometimes plays that don't have any necessary conclusion, that actually leave the audience with more questions than answers, that if, 50 people walk out of the theatre and they're all thinking it's about something different, then that's a kind of very exciting. Do you understand me?
Yeah, so I completely agree.
Things don't need to be concluded for me always.
Sometimes just an examination of the subject is
worth
enough.
Yeah, I think so.
So, this is paradoxical, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, I'm very interested, like yourself, in storytelling through different mediums, whether it be books, literature, there's stand-up comedy as a medium, there's film and theatre. We know as audiences that we're being manipulated, right?
We know that
a story's being contrived, and yet it can be such an amazing affective experience.
Exactly. I mean, it's a bit like getting on a roller coaster. You're going to be scared, but you're still, and part of that is the queuing up, hearing other people screaming. We know that's going to happen to us.
The anticipation.
But it's that that's why we're drawn sometimes into films like thrillers and those kinds of things, because we want to know. I mean, at its earliest, things like Agatha Christie was hugely successful.
Yeah, we talked about Death on the Nile
just
recently.
Hugely successful. I mean, the Mousetrap, which had been running for God knows how many centuries in London. I mean, now it's more of a tourist attraction, but it still has that kind of element of surprise to it.
In fairness, a lot of the modern sort of mystery detectives, they really do sort of still base themselves
exactly,
on that.
Exactly. And then things like Woman in Black,
yes,
which is a great play.
Yes.
In fact, for me, it's a better play than it is a film, which has just basically two actors.
Right.
And I've taken drama students to see that show in London. And, of course, the first half, they go, well, it's not scary at all. And by the second half, they're biting into your shoulders,
right,
because they're so terrified. And that's pure, very clever use of lighting, sound, stings that I talked about, sudden sounds.
Yes.
And just playing with your imagination, and that's why I think
shows how incredibly powerful these visual and audio cues can be.
Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Stephen, we're running short on time, but I did want to discuss briefly a little bit of your film work here in Malta. So
absolutely.
Recently a production called Blood on the Crown was shot here, and you had a role in the film, but you were also involved as a dialogue coach to one of the main actors.
I was indeed, yeah. I mean, this is the piece about what happened in Malta.
Right, the uprising.
Exactly, and I was very lucky to get a role in it, but then I was approached to be asked if I would be dialogue coach to Harvey Keitel.
Wow.
Because he needed to be a British governor.
Right.
And so he had to approve me.
Okay.
And then I was on the phone to him every night in L.A., working with him on his script.
Over the phone?
For like 3 weeks.
Gosh.
And then when he arrived in Malta, I was working with him in his hotel, and then I was on set with him every single day with an earpiece in, correcting him as he went along. He did a really good job, actually. He did a very, very good job. And it's weird because this suddenly has become a new career for me, because I've now done 4 movies as a dialogue coach. 3 of those I've been in as well. And in fact, I'm just about to start another film in July. Christina, Star of Malta, which is based on the story of Christina Ratcliffe, the English singer who came here and fell in love with an English airman. Okay. It's based on the play Star of Straight Street that was very successful here a few years ago. And I've been hired in that as an American.
Okay.
But I'm also the dialogue coach to the main actor. So this is kind of, I've carved out a bit of a new career for myself, really, which is lovely. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
And I do a lot of work with actors, professional actors online. I'm working with a French actress who's been in Mission Impossible and that kind of stuff.
So actors who are based overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Suddenly the work has started to come in. So it's kind of a new area for me, really, and one that really interests me. I mean, I've always been good at things like accents, and you know, my accent, my original accent, is a broad West Country accent. My brother still talks like that.
Well, from Cornwall, from Dorset,
Gloucestershire.
Gloucestershire, yeah.
Okay, so I've always been very interested in RP and developing sounds and those kinds of things, and that's kind of how I worked with Harvey, really.
And how was he to work with?
Oh, he was an absolute delight.
He's a consummate professional.
He was really sweet. Huge hug on his last day. Thank you so much for everything you've done. His wife was very nice to me as well. And he worked really hard. I mean, he's a method actor anyway.
Right.
But he was so wanted to get it right. And that was what was such a delight. I mean, he used to moan and groan at me. Oh, God, it's that English limey on the phone again. But because he and Malcolm McDowell, who's also in this film, they're great buddies.
Okay.
So at one stage, I rang Malcolm's house because Harvey was staying there. Okay. So he answered. So it's kind of a weird scenario, really. But I bullied him throughout, and he took my bullying.
He took it.
Because he knew I was an actor as well. So we're talking off the same sheet, you know. It's like...
But it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because when we see professionals giving performances, and it seems so natural, we assume it almost comes naturally. But, of course, even the people at the top of their game have to work very hard.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's a reason he's so well-known. There's a reason why he's won so many awards and so on. He's a wonderful man to work with.
That's great. Stephen, this was so interesting. We're out of time. If people want to find out a bit more about the various productions you've worked on, is there a website online?
Yeah, I have a website, which is Stephen with a PH, roliver.com.
Great.
Okay.
Fantastic. Well, we wish you the very best of luck, and we hope we'll be seeing lots more on theatre and hopefully on the big screen very, very soon, Stephen.
It's been my pleasure, Andrew. Thank you very much indeed.
Our pleasure too. Well then, what about movies that go deep on psychology that were shot here in Malta? Well, why don't you try this wetsuit on for size? A group of friends go swimming, but fail to lower the ladder of their boat, finding themselves stranded in the sea and struggling to survive.
I'm hot. I want to go swimming.
You boys want to take a dip?
Oh, God, no, please. Please just put me down.
Where's the ladder?
There has to be a way. Sarah's still up there.
If it weren't for you, Dad, I wouldn't be here right now.
from 2006. This is Open Water 2 Adrift, which is actually a German production directed by Hans Horn. It was apparently shot entirely on the Maltese Islands, at the water tanks at the Malta Film Studios, of course, but also partially on Gozo. And a little note to aficionados of the original Open Water movie from 2003, or indeed to people who hate films about getting eaten by sea monsters, this second open water movie does not feature any sharks. Rather, it appears to be a deep psychological dive into the fathomless fear of simply being stranded at sea. Yeesh. The film got somewhat mixed reviews, but a few commentators rated it really quite well, praising Horn's solid direction in particular. So if you're seeking examples of Malta shot films which dispense with the grand vistas and historic locales, instead honing in on the mental processes surrounding fear and panic, then maybe you ought to don a sturdy life vest and check it out. Venturing beyond the seemingly endless expanse of sea surrounding Malta now, let's discover films which truly dive deep on psychology. We start with an excerpt from the musical soundtrack of our next movie. The theme is composed by Maurice Jarre. Haunted Vietnam War veteran mourns his dead child. Attempting to uncover his past, he must decipher reality and life from his own dreams, delusions, and perceptions of death.
Every day, Jacob Singer goes to work.
What's wrong? It's one of those days.
And every day, he wonders what is happening to him.
Maybe it's the pressure, Jake.
They're like demons, Jess.
What were they, Jake?
From 1990, this is Adrian Lyne's increasingly well-regarded horror drama, Jacob's Ladder. Well, this seems to be one of those films that, despite its age, remains timeless, almost floating in suspended cinematic animation, if you will. Tim Robbins gives one of his most serious roles, alongside his deliberative turn in Frank Darabont's The Shawshank Redemption. Here in Jacob's Ladder, Robbins gives us a vivid portrayal of a traumatized man whose psyche appears to be fragmenting before his, and indeed our very own, eyes.
Then look at your hand.
You have a very strange line.
See, according to this, you're already dead.
Something's wrong, Jake. They're coming after me. I don't know who they are or what they are, but they're gonna get me, and I'm scared, Jake.
I've seen them too.
Featuring disturbing imagery, creature effects, and sound design, there are some vintage fantasy horror sequences here. As in recent episodes of our show, with the film's First Blood in episode 9 and Born on the 4th of July in episode 11, here we have yet another serious drama exploring the psychological devastation of wartime soldiers coming home from active duty. A clear sign, then, of what a critical and much-studied theme this was in late 20th century cinema. Well, like any psychological drama focusing on mental fragmentation, relief comes through moments of sanity. Here, they're afforded to Jacob through his healthy relationship with chiropractor Louis, played with characteristic warmth by Danny Aiello.
Well, you've done it to yourself this time, haven't you?
Am I dying, Louis? From the slip disc? That'll be a first. I was in hell. I don't want to die, Louis.
And I'll see what I can do about it.
This is a somber film and a visceral cinematic experience, even now, more than 30 years after it was made. A vast visual and auditory palette is employed. Check out the sound design here, when Jacob startles awake on a subway train, deep under the bowels of the dark, dank cityscape. Now, shrewd film buffs may be aware that Jacob's Ladder was remade very recently in 2019 in an update directed by David M. Rosenthal. And that remake was widely panned by reviewers. But I watched it anyway. And I'll tell you what, I was very pleasantly surprised. The remake of Jacob's Ladder is a very good movie, confidently treading the ominous tropes of psychological horror with good visuals, music, and acting. So I'd actually recommend both versions of this film. But you must start, of course, with the original and by now seminal horror drama from 1990 that is Jacob's Ladder.
Maybe the demons are real.
He's running 106 feet with...
This is barbaric.
I can get rid of the demons.
Who are you?
I can block the ladder.
Where are you taking me? Where am I?
Where do you want to go?
Home.
This is your home. You're dead.
I'm not dead.
What are you then?
I'm alive.
We jump forward into 21st century genre cinema now. Oscar, an overlooked and bullied boy, finds the promise of deliverance through Ellie, a beautiful but most peculiar girl. Behold a film that's really quite supremely special. From 2008, this is Thomas Alfredson's Swedish crime drama, Let the Right One In. And boy, oh boy, if you've not seen this one, are you ever in for a treat? Adapted from a novel by John Ayurveda Lindqvist, this film's dialogue is entirely in Swedish. You absolutely must see the film in its native tongue, though, with subtitles. Indeed, I couldn't even find any English-dubbed clips for the film for inclusion here. Thus, most of what you'll hear today from this movie is from the sublime soundtrack of Let the Right One In. Now look, this is a genre movie superbly exploiting and indeed subverting one of horror's most intriguing subgenres. It includes a couple of grisly scenes, to be sure, but don't let that deter you. This is principally a psychological drama of the most fantastical kind. I mean, every kid is tormented at school. We all felt destitute and lonely at times in our childhood, right? This story beautifully recalls those sad episodes, centering on the burgeoning relationship between two young, haunted children. They initially meet in the snowy playground outside their apartment complex.
Where is that?
The head. Det är en Rubiks kub.
Är det ett pussel?
Ja. Vill du låna den?
No need to focus on the words here. It's the gentle dynamic developing that's key. And we have two child actors here who achieve quite staggering levels of vulnerability in their on-screen performance. I can think of few modern examples of such talented youths on screen. An absolute joy to behold, if a heartbreaking one. Plot-wise, the less said on this one, the better. But suffice it to say that at a Freudian level, this whole movie represents wish fulfillment of the most absolutely wonderful and sincere kind. Director Alfredson and his team are undoubtedly performing at the absolute top of their game here. Outwardly a modest production, Let the Right One In is a movie so deep in its understanding of the cinematic medium, the viewing experience almost becomes transcendental. The power of suggestion and implied narrative beats are rife, yet the genre trappings remain, and what an explosive combination this turns out to be. In a pivotal scene, the school kids are taken on an outing on a frozen lake. Several key story strands combine here in a shocking dramatic crescendo. It's emblematic of the superb directorial and narrative judgment employed throughout this movie. To appreciate through audio alone, the visual medium of film is exploited perfectly in that clip. Look, I could talk for hours and hours about this film. Countless fellow film freaks have affirmed to me that they hold the movie in similarly high esteem to myself. Indeed, it's been a darling of the critics from the outset. Part of its joy is in the discovery, so I'm at pains to avoid details. Suffice it to say, though, that the movie's build-up works towards an emotionally epic climax. Can horror truly be a vehicle for serious drama? Well, in evidence, I humbly present this movie as exhibit triple A. The final scene, in a mirror of the opening, nods at countless noir predecessors. 'Tis a heartbreaking masterstroke of understatement. Truly terrific stuff. This film, like Jacob's Ladder, also got a remake 2 years later in the American 2010 film Let Me In, starring genre regular Chloe Grace Moretz. I confess to being unfamiliar with the remake, so terrified am I that it'll spoil this original. That said, the US remake, too, got pretty good reviews. But if I've piqued your cinematic taste buds, then do yourself a favour. A modern genre masterpiece and no mistaking it, do please begin with the 2008 Swedish original that is the truly transcendental movie experience. Let the right one in. And before moving on, here's another lovely theme from the film's towering musical soundtrack. The composer here also wrote the music for a movie that was partially shot here in Malta. I'm speaking of 2012's adventure drama, Kon-Tiki, which we discussed back in episode 8 of the first season of our show. The composer for both these Swedish films is Johan Söderqvist. Move down under for our next psychological flick. A single mother and her child fall deep into a well of paranoia when an eerie children's book seemingly begins to manifest in their own home.
Where'd you get this?
On the shelf.
If it's in a word or it's in a look, you can't get rid of the Babadook. A rumbling sound, then three sharp knocks.
Babadook.
That's when you'll know he's around. You'll see him if you look.
From 2014, this is the mystery horror drama The Babadook. The Aussies are certainly no strangers to genre cinema, having produced several really strong pieces over the last few decades. Many of them were backed by federal funding entity Screen Australia, as was the case here. Director Jennifer Kent pulls out all the stops, turning a creaky old Victorian-era house into a chilling haunted setting. But don't for a minute think that's all this film has to offer. It centres on a widowed mother and her struggles to take care of her young son.
Nothing bad's gonna happen, Sam.
Did he think that about my dad before he died?
He sees things as they are, that one.
I promised to protect you if he promised to protect me.
Oh, my God. Did he hurt anyone?
The boy has significant behavioral problems.
This monster thing has got to stop, all right? It's just a book. It can't hurt you.
There's a solid performance by child actor Noah Wiseman, but the film really belongs to Essie Davis as the tormented mother. She is Oscar-worthy here, in my view. If ever a portrayal of a psychological collapse was worthy of Academy recognition, this has to be it. To be fair, the film did get plenty of awards from other festivals. The beauty here is in the narrative ambiguity. The film can be read in at least two ways, functioning superbly in either guise. In particular, witness the metaphorical terror waged on this broken family. And intriguingly, where did that book actually come from? Charming and chilling cinematic concepts at work here. Viewers familiar with this style of Australian filmmaking will recognise some knowing nods to familiar family drama tropes from Down Under, such as here, when social workers pay mother and son an exploratory but friendly visit.
Sam's just like his dad was. Always speaks his mind.
Parties are lots of fun, especially when they're yours.
My cousin's not coming because I broke her nose in two places.
I'll take that for you.
It has to be said, this is psychological horror, and in several scenes it's more than a little unnerving. But the screenplay is so deftly written, the story beats so cogently paced out, the focus remains firmly on the genesis of the monster that's plaguing this hapless house. Of course, thematically, it certainly evokes Toby Hooper's seminal 1982 psychological thriller, Poltergeist, although the tonal signature here, and indeed the narrative focus, is decidedly different.
You all right?
Yeah, no, I'm fine.
You don't have to be fine, you know.
Just a bit stressed at the moment.
All children see monsters.
Not like these.
I want to report someone stalking me and my child.
You can't get rid of the Babadook.
You can bring me the boy. You can bring me the boy.
A final act brings everything together in a heartbreaking psychological revelation. Talk about dark corners and ominous sound design. The cinematography is a stunning example of what can be done with lighting in a single location. And my sense is that Kent, as screenwriter as well as director, shows tremendous adeptness with the machinations of mental illness, dysfunction, and depression that's so central to her protagonist's ongoing torment. Brilliantly unsettling, then, for a deep psychological foray into the intriguing canon of Australian genre movies awaiting your discovery, I can heartily recommend a big box of tissues and 2014's The Babadook.
It isn't real. It isn't real. It isn't real.
Baba.
Finally for today then, for the more rambunctious thrill seekers tuning in, I've got one for you lot. When a group of university students take a snowboarding trip into the snowy woods in their SUV, things take a predictable turn for the worse. Or do they?
Often overshadowed by the more well-known witch trials of Salem, disenfranchised young women began to experience violent fits and hallucinations. The village pastor made the swift diagnosis of possession by the devil, witchcraft. Their anomalous behavior became attributed to the land itself.
Hey, Derek, I got a new idea. We pull over, and we just chuck Jill right off.
You, hey,
this is my baby. I got you back.
Put the phone out of my face. Okay, relax.
Moving right up to 2019, this is Jordan Barker's mystery thriller, Witches in the Woods. Now look here then, we've all seen the classic American horror movie opening, right? A group of feisty youngsters, hot and horny and jammed into a ramshackle SUV, take a cocksure trip out into the wilderness. Along the way, they stop for supplies at an outback gas station and have a run-in with a moody, suspicious-looking yokel. Then they venture off-piste, where things go horribly wrong. Right? Well, Witches in the Woods seems no different. Indeed, the film's opening goes to such pains adhering to tired genre tropes. Well, I couldn't help but wonder if it didn't have a little something up its sleeve. Impressively, in an early scene in the jam-packed Jeep, the technical prowess of the filmmakers is on full display. We do a slow but complete 360-degree rotation around the interior of the vehicle, with each cast member picking up their lines as the drifting camera floats past them, right on cue. It's skillful directing and, indeed, acting.
We had a
ski resort.
Roads closed, I'm afraid.
Trust me, I will save us at least an hour.
All
right! What do you think she did?
Copulate it with the devil. Did I do that?
I'm so sorry.
Derek, look out!
There's a moment as the hormone-laden 4x4 ventures ever deeper into unknown territory. One of the young ladies spies a black raven sitting on a post at the roadside. The bird squawks ominously in slow motion at the passing vehicle. Chilling sound design backs up a deliciously unnerving moment of thematic foreshadowing. Clever and effective stuff.
Hey, everybody out. We're stuck. We gotta push.
This thing isn't going anywhere.
Does anybody have the signal yet? We need to let someone know we're out here.
We're not getting out of here. What? We can't see you tonight.
I'll go for help.
I'll go with you.
They've been gone a really long time.
What was that?
Hannah Kasulka, as the lead, uses her stunning grey eyes to luminous effect here. Quite remarkable. The ensemble cast as a whole, actually, is a refreshing change. They behave quite plausibly, given the unusual setting. This helps sell us on the idea that it could be us caught out there in the icy woods, freezing our proverbials off in the stranded sports utility vehicle.
Hey, can you turn the heat for a little bit? I can't feel my toes. Derek.
As you might expect, things go from bad to worse, with the potential identity of the ne'er-do-gooder becoming more and more unclear.
Go around this bend.
That's the same path we went down an hour
ago. Derek, look out!
Someone has to go for help.
No way, bro. We freeze out there.
We could freeze in here. What the hell is that?
The ending is left nicely open to interpretation, another of Barker's knowing nods to the countless flicks of its ilk that have gone before. Strong moments of violence and scares abound, though, so this one isn't for the faint of heart. Arguably, none of today's films are, really, given that they all play with the mind, and in particular with the film viewer's expectations, psychological movies that they all are. But for an intriguing independent take on the Lost in the Boonies movie gambit, I think you might want to take Witches in the Woods for a ride.
Violent fits, just like she said. The pamphlet she read. This place is getting possessed. Dude, she's causing this to happen. She's punishing us.
So, what did you think of our movie selection today? Please email us at morethanamovieqs@gmail.com. That's morethanamovieqs, all one word, @gmail.com. This More Than a Movie episode was written and presented by me, Andrew Bonello. A big thanks to our guest, Stephen Oliver, for joining us, and also, of course, to our sound engineer today, Redent Abdillah. The intro music was Creepy Comedy, and the outro is Inspiring Teaser, both by Raphael Crux at filmmusic.io. Those clips are licensed under creativecommons.org, version 4. Thanks for listening, and please join us again for the last episode in this season of More Than a Movie.